Good evening, everyone. And it gives me great pleasure to introduce two phenomenally gifted, talented writers on a rare visit to the UK, Robert Coover at the far end and Ewen Lee closest to me. Before I say anything else, I would also like to express our gratitude to EFG Private Bank, which has supported this event, and also supports the Sunday Times Short Story Prize. Robert Coover is the author of very many award-winning works of fiction and plays. His writing commands a cult following in the US, and he's a legend in the literary scene, with admirers such as Angela Carter, who described him as unfair, rude, cruel, and murderously funny, a master, and Salman Rushdie, who commented, "Mr. Coover's work has long occupied a place of honour. He goes at his task with an almost alarming linguistic energy and a ferocious love of everything comic and grotesque." Robert Coover teaches cave writing at Brown University, and now I'm not going to tell you what that is because that gives you your first question when we finish at the end. And so he teaches cave writing at Brown University and directs the International Writers Project, a Freedom to Write program, which you can also ask him about. Penguin has just published three of his books as modern classics, which is a great accolade. Gerald's Party, which is a novel, and the short fiction collections Prick Songs and Descants and Briar Rose and Spanking the Maid. Ewen Lee, this is her second visit to Small Wonder, grew up in Beijing and left for America in 1996 in order to obtain a postgraduate qualification in immunology. Well, the rest is history. Her debut collection of short stories, A Thousand Years of Good Prayers, won the Frank O'Connor International Short Story Award, the most lucrative prize for a collection of short fiction. And in fact, she has just been on the shortlist for this year, I think the only writer who has won the prize and has subsequently been on the shortlist again. In fact, I think the only writer has been on the shortlist twice. For the same collection, she also won the Guardian First Fiction Award and in America, the Penn Hemingway Award, as well as very many other awards, but I'd spend all night telling you about them. Her novel, The Vagrants, won the Gold Medal of California Book Award for Fiction, and was greatly admired by very many people here, including A.S. Byatt, who chose it as her book of the year. Ewen was selected by Granta as one of the 21 best young American novelists under 35, and by The New Yorker as one of the top 20 American writers under 40. So she may have grown up a little bit between those two. her most recent collection of stories, for which she was on the Frank O'Connor shortlist, Gold Boy, Emerald Girl, displays her commitment to the inner lives of her characters, as well as to illuminating cultural and historical shifts in Chinese society. The Guardian review of that book said, "At the heart of this hugely impressive collection is Lee's delicate weighing of silence versus speech, her acknowledgement of the uselessness of words in the face of violence and repression." I would add to that her instinct, her astonishing instinct for characterization and for entering into the minds and hearts of her characters. Ewen lives with her family in Oakland, California, where she teaches at Davis University. Well, as at the University of California, Davis. So I'm going to hand over to Ewen, who's going to read from her work and talk a little bit. Then she will hand over to Robert, and then they'll welcome questions from the audience. Ewen Lee.
Thank you, Diana. Can you hear me all right? Thank you, Diana, for having me again. This is really one of the best places for short stories. I think I'm going to do a little bit different. I always like to, well, I would prefer not to read my own work. So, but I am going to, so I'm going to start reading William Trevor's work so that you can hear a little, because many of the stories in this collection, I admire William Trevor very much. And many of the stories in this collection were written originally to talk to Trevor's stories. So I'm going to read one page from Trevor, and so you could sort of get a sense how stories talk to each other. So this is actually, I would say it's a novella by Trevor called Nights at Alexandra. So it was set in a provincial Irish town and was told by this older man, you know, looking back at his life. I'm just going to read you the first page before I read my work. I am a 58-year-old provincial. I have no children. I have never married. Harry, I have the happiest marriage in the world. Please, when you think of me, remember that. That is what I hear most often and with the greatest pleasure. Frau Messenger's voice, as precisely recorded as memory allows, each quizzical intonation reflected in a glance or gesture. I must have replied something, heaven knows what. It never mattered, because she rarely listened. The war had upset the messenger's lives, she being an Englishwoman and he German. It brought them to Ireland and to Clover Hill, a sanctuary they most certainly would not otherwise have known. She explained to me that she would not have found life comfortable in Hitler's Germany, and her own country could hardly be a haven for her husband. They had thought of a Switzerland, but her messengers believed that Switzerland would be invaded, and the United States did not tempt them. No one but I, at that time an unprepossessing youth of 15, ever used their German titles. In the town where I had been born, they were Mr. and Mrs. Messenger. Yet it seemed to me, affectation I dare say, that in this way we should honor the strangers that they were. So that's the opening page of the Trevor novella. And it went on about this man looking back at his life and his friendship with this couple. And I carried that novella with me for quite a while, you know, for a couple years. Whenever I traveled, I would carry it. I would read that on an airplane. And so I was in New York City for an event, and I was in the hotel, and this woman's voice just came to me. Partly, I think this woman's voice came to me talking to the narrator in Trevor's novella. So I started to write, and it became the first story in my collection called Kindness. So I'm going to read you a little bit so you can hear this woman's voice. And you can clearly see the opening is an echo of the Trevor opening. I am a 41-year-old, I am a 41-year-old woman living by myself in the same one-bedroom flat where I have always lived, in a derelict building at outskirts of Beijing that is threatened to be demolished by government-backed real estate developers. Apart from a trip to a cheap seaside resort taken with my parents the summer I turned 5, I have not traveled much. I spent a year in an army camp in central China, but other than that, I have never lived away from home. In college, after a few failed attempts to convince me the importance of being a community member, my advisor stopped acknowledging my presence, and the bed assigned to me was taken over by the 5 other girls in the dorm and their trunks. I have not married, and naturally have no children. I have few friends, though as I have never left the neighborhood, I have enough acquaintances, most of them a generation or two older. Being around them is comforting. Never is there a day when I feel that I am alone in aging. I teach mathematics in the middle school. I do not love my job or my students. But I have noticed that even the most meager attention I give to the students is returned by a few of them with respect and gratitude and sometimes inexplicable infatuation. I pity those children more than I appreciate them, as I can see where they are heading in their lives. It is a terrible thing, you see, even for an indifferent person like me, to see the bleakness lurking in someone else's life. I have no hobby that takes me outside my flat during my spare time. I do not own a television set. But I have a room full of old books. At least half a century older than I am. I have never in my life hurt a soul, or if I have done any harm unintentionally, the pain I inflict is the most trivial kind, forgotten the moment it's felt, if indeed it could be felt in any way. But that cannot be a happy life, or much of a life at all, you might say. That may very well be true. Why are you unhappy? To this day, if I close my eyes, I can feel Lieutenant Wei's finger under my chin, lifting my face to a spring night. Tell me, how can we make you happy? The questions put to me 23 years ago have remained unanswerable, though it no longer matters. As you see, Lieutenant Wei died 3 weeks ago, at age 46, mother of a teenage daughter, wife of a stationery merchant, veteran of Unit 20256, People's Liberation Army, from which she retired at 43, already afflicted with a malignant tumor. She was Major Wei in the funeral announcement. I do not know why the news of her death was mailed to me, except perhaps the funeral committee thought I was one of her long-lost friends, my name scribbled in an old address book. I wonder if an announcement was sent to the other girls, though not many of them would still be at the same address. I remember the day Lieutenant Wei's wedding invitation arrived in the distant past, and thinking then that would be the last time I would hear from her. I did not go to the funeral, as I had not gone to her wedding, both of which took place 2 hours by train from Beijing. It is a hassle to travel for a wedding, but more so for a funeral. One has to face strangers' tears and words. One has to repeat words of condolence to irrelevant people. When I was 5, a peddler came to our neighborhood one Sunday with a bamboo basket full of spring chicks. I was trailing behind my father for our weekly shopping of rationed food, and when the peddler put a chick in my palm, its small body soft and warm and shivering constantly, I cried before I could ask my father to buy it for me. We were not a rich family. My father worked as a janitor, and my mother, ill for as long as I could remember, did not work. And I learned early to count coins and small bills with my father before we set out to shop. It must have been a painful thing for those who knew our stories to watch my father's distress as two women offered to buy two chicks for me. My father, on the way home, warned me gently that the chicks were too young to last more than a day or two. I built a nest for the chicks out of shoebox and ripped a newspaper, and fed them water-soaked and millet grains, and a day later, when they looked ill, aspirin dissolved in water. 2 days later, they died. The one I named Dot and marked with ink on his forehead, the first to go, followed by Mushroom. I stole 2 eggs from the kitchen when my father went to help a neighbor to fix a leaking sink. My mother was not around those days. I cracked the eggs carefully and washed away the yolks and whites. But no matter how hard I tried, I could not fit the chicks back into the shells. And I can see to this day the half shell on Dot's head, carrying the ink spot like a funny little hat. I have learned since then that life is like that, each day ending up like a chick refusing to be returned to the eggshell. That's the opening of this woman's voice, I'm going to read you another excerpt where she first met this woman, professor. A dream has occurred repeatedly over the past 20 years in which I have to give up my present life and return to the army. Always Lieutenant Wei in the dream. In the early years, she would smile cruelly at me. Didn't I tell you that you would be back? The question was put to me in various ways, but the coldness remained the same. The dreams had become less wicked over the years. I am back, I tell Lieutenant Wei. I always knew you'd come back, she replies. We are older, having aged in my dreams as we have in real life, the only remnants of a previous life among a group of chirpy teenage girls. These dreams upset me. Lieutenant Wei's marriage 2 years after I had left the army, and her transfer to another city, which would know her only as a married woman and later a mother, and then would see her die, must have wiped her history clean so she could start collecting new memories, not about young, miserable girls in a camp, but about happy people who deserve to be remembered. I never showed up in her dreams, I am certain. As people we keep in our memories rarely have a place for us in theirs. You may say that we too evict people from our hearts while we continue living in theirs. And that may very well be true for some people. But I wonder if I'm an anomaly. I have never forgotten a person who has come into my life. And perhaps it is for that reason I cannot have much of a life myself. The people I carry with me have lived out not only their own rations, but mine too, though they are innocent usurpers of my life, and I have only myself to blame. For instance, there's Professor Shen. She was in her early 60s when I met her, but this may be the wrong way to put it, as she had lived in the same neighborhood for as long as my father had. She must have watched my generation grow up and studied every one of us before singling me out. I like to imagine it that way. You see, for a lonely woman, it is hard not to make up some scenario that allows her to believe herself special in some minor ways. Professor Shen was in her early 60s and I was 12 when she approached me one September evening. I was on my way to the milk stations. Do you have a minute? She asked. I looked down at the two empty bottles snuggled in the little carrier my father had woven for me. He had painted the dried reed different colors and the basket had an intricate pattern, though by then the colors had all paled. My father had a pair of hands that were good at making things. The wooden packs he put on the foyer wall for my school satchel and coat had red beaks and black eyes. The cardboard wardrobe had two windows that you could push open from the inside. He had built my bed, too, a small wooden one, painted orange, just big enough to fit into the foyer alongside the wardrobe. We lived in a small one-room unit, the room itself serving as my parents' bedroom, the foyer my bedroom. There was a small cube of a kitchen and a smaller cube of a bathroom next to the foyer. Later it occurred to me that we could not afford much furniture, but when I was young, I thought it was a hobby of my father's to make things with his own hands. Once upon a time, he must have made things for my mother too. But from the time my memory began, their bedroom had two single beds, my father's bare and neatly made, and my mother's piled with old novels. Do you have a minute? I'm asking you. The old woman said again. I had developed a look of distractedness by then, and she was not the most patient woman. I'm going to skip a little. So she went to the professor's apartment. Professor Shen's place, a one-room unit also, seemed more crowded than ours, even though she lived there by herself. Apart from a table, a chair, and a single bed, the room was filled with trunks. Dark leather ones with intricate patterns on the tops and sides, wooden ones with rusty metal clips, and two matching trunks, once bleached, but by then more yellow than white, made of bamboo or perhaps straw, I couldn't tell which. On each trunk there were books. She moved a pile of books to make a spot for me to sit on her single bed and took the seat in the only chair. Up to that point, I had not studied her, but I realized now that she was a beautiful woman, even at her age. Her hair, grayish-white, was combed into a tight bun, not a single strand running loose. Her face, the high cheekbones, the very prominent forehead, and deep-set eyes, reminded me of a photograph of a female Soviet pilot in my textbook. I wondered if Professor Shan had some mixed blood. It was a secret joy of mine to study people's faces. I must take after my mother, who, apart from studying my face at meals, the table placed between the two beds in my parents' bedroom, rarely took a bite. Sometimes waiting for us to finish eating, she would comment on the people passing outside our window. Oily and puffy as fresh fried dough, she described a woman living a floor above us. The man next door had a long and bitter-looking face like a cucumber. My mother was the prettiest woman I had known until then, with almond-shaped eyes in a small, heart-shaped face, a straight and delicate nose, and, as I later learned from her collection of romantic novels from the early 1900s, a cherry petal mouth. When she grew tired of watching the world, she would study her own face in an oval mirror. A princess trapped in the fate of a handmaiden, she would say to no one in particular. My father, eating silently, would look up at her with an apologetic smile, as if he were a parent responsible for his child's deformed body. My father had married late in his life, my mother early, he at 50 and she at 20. 2 years later, they had me, their only child. When I was in elementary school, other children often mistook him for my grandfather, but perhaps that was because he had to be a parent to my mother, too. Together, my mother and I made my father grow old fast. You could see that in his stooped back and sad smile. I'm going to skip a little, and she was still in the professor's room. She studied me while I looked around the room, then picked up a notebook and turned to a random page. "Read the line to me," she said. The book was the first one in a series called Essential English, which Professor Shan had used to learn English 50 years ago. The page had a small cartoon of a child on a seat, the kind one would find in a luxury theater. In the cartoon, the child, who was not heavy enough to keep the seat from folding back, smiled uncertainly on his high perch, and I felt the same. I had entered middle school earlier that month and had barely learned my alphabet. When I could not read the caption, Professor Shan put the book back with the other volumes, their spines different colors that were equally faded. "You do know that you are not your parents' birth daughter, don't you?" She turned and faced me. "And you do know that no matter how nicely they treat you, they can't do much for your education, don't you?" I had not doubted my blood until then. I knew that my parents were different from other parents, but I had thought that it was their age difference and my mother's illness. "Mo Yan," my mother sometimes said my name in a soft voice when my father was not around, and I would know that she had some secrets to tell me. "A man can have children until he's 70, she would say. "A woman's youth ends the moment she marries. Mo Yan, do not let a man touch you, especially here and here," she would say, gesturing vaguely toward her own body. "Mo Yan, Your father would get your stepmother the moment I die, she would say, narrowing her eyes in an amused way. Do you know I cannot die because I don't want you to live under a stepmother? In one of those revelatory moments, she could have said, Mo Yan, you were not born to us. We only picked you up from a garbage dump. But no, my mother had never, even in her most uncharitable moment, said that to me. And in fact, she kept the secret until her death. And for that alone, I loved her and love her still. If your parents haven't told you this, someone else must, Professor Shen said, when I did not reply. One needs to know where she came from, do you understand? I'm going to stop here. The story would go on. Thank you. So the story would go on, and the professor took her under her, you know, the professor educated her to read English by reading English novels to her, and mostly, you know, Hardy and D.H. Lawrence, and later she moved into, starting with Dickens, and then moved into Hardy, and then D.H. Lawrence. And by the time she went to the army, the professor, you know, had a very strict rule about her love life. So she left the professor, and before she left, she stole a copy of Lawrence's stories from the professor. And when she was in the army, she would read these stories, and she would read a lot. She would read in her mind and imagining the professor's voice reading to her. And when she was in the army, there's just a little bit, just spoiler. There was the other girl in the army camp. She got hold of a copy of Lady Chatterley's Lover, which was banned in China at the time. So the other friend asked the narrator to read Lady Chatterley's Lover and marked all the sex scenes because the other woman did not want to read English, but she wanted to have a sex education. So this narrator in the army, she started to read, you know, Lady Chatterley's Lover. She marked everything, and she was caught by the officer, Lieutenant Wei, who, you know, showed up at the beginning of the story. So that started another friendship, and the story just goes on and on, and I think I'm just going to stop here. Thank you very much.
Part of the purpose here, I suppose, for why I'm here has to do with the fact that Penguin has brought out these books and they would like me to help them get rid of them. Consequently, I probably should be reading from the Book of Short Fictions, Brick Songs and Descants. But I'm going instead to read some very brand new work willing to answer questions later about the early days. So this one was just recently published. It's called Going for a Beer. He finds himself sitting in the neighborhood bar drinking a beer at about the same time that he began to think about going there for one. In fact, he has finished it. Perhaps he'll have a second one, he thinks, as he downs it and asks for a third. There's a young woman sitting not far from him who is not exactly good-looking, but good-looking enough and probably good in bed, as indeed she is. Did he finish his beer? Can't remember. What really matters is, did he enjoy his orgasm or even have one? This is wandering on his way home through the foggy night streets from the young woman's apartment, which was full of Cupid dolls, the sort one at carnivals, and they made a date, as he recalls, to go to one. Where? She wins another. She has a knack for it. Whereupon, they're in her apartment again, taking their clothes off, she excitedly cuddling her new doll in a bed heaped with them. He can't remember when he last slept, and he's no longer sure as he staggers through the night streets, still foggy, where his own apartment is, his orgasm, if he had one, already fading from memory. Maybe he should take her back to the carnival, he thinks, where she wins another Cupid doll. This is at least their second date, or maybe their fourth, and this time they go for a romantic nightcap at the bar where they first met, where a brawny dude starts hassling her. He intervenes, and she turns up at his hospital bed, bringing him one of her Cupid dolls to keep him company, which is her way of expressing the bond between them, or so he supposes as he leaves the hospital on crutches, uncertain what part of town he is in or what part of the year. He decides that it's time to call the affair off. She's driving him crazy. But then the brawny dude turns up at their wedding and apologizes for the pounding he gave him. He didn't realize, he says, how serious they were. The guy's wedding present is a gift certificate for two free drinks at the bar where they met and a pair of white satin ribbons for his crutches. During the ceremony, they both carry Cupid dolls that probably have some barely hidden significance, and indeed do. The child she bears him, his or another's, reminds him, as if he needed reminding, that time is fast moving on. He has responsibilities now, and he decides to check whether he still has the job that he had when he first met her. He does. His absence, if he has been absent, is not remarked on, but he is not congratulated on his marriage either. No doubt because, it comes back to him now, before he met his wife, he was engaged to one of his colleagues, and their co-workers had already thrown them an engagement party, so they must resent the money they spent on gifts. It's embarrassing. And the atmosphere is somewhat hostile, but he has a child in kindergarten and another on the way, so what can he do? Well, he still hasn't cashed in the gift certificate. So one thing, what the hell, he can go for a beer. Two, in fact, and he can afford a third. There's a young woman sitting near him who looks like she's probably good in bed, but she's not his wife, and he has no desire to commit adultery or... So he tells himself as he sits on the edge of her bed with his pants around his ankles. Is he taking them off or putting them on? He's not sure, but now he pulls them on and limps home, having left his beribboned crutches somewhere. On arrival, he finds all the Cupid dolls, which were put on a shelf when the baby started coming, now scattered about the apartment, beheaded and with their limbs amputated. One of the babies is crying, so while he warms up a bottle of milk on the stove, he goes into its room to give it a pacifier and discovers a note from his wife pinned to its pajamas, which says she's gone off to the hospital to have another baby and she'd better not find him here when she gets back, because if she does, she'll kill him. He believes her, so he's soon out on the streets again, wondering if he ever gave that bottle to the baby or if it's still boiling away on the stove. He passes the old neighborhood bar and is tempted, but decides he's had enough trouble for one lifetime and is about to walk on when he's stopped by that hulk who beat him up and who now gives him a cigar because he's just become a father and drags him into the bar for a celebratory drink, or rather several, he's lost count. The celebrations are already over, however, and the new father, who is married to the same woman who threw him out, is crying in his beer about the miseries of married life and congratulating him on being well out of it, a lucky man. But he doesn't feel lucky, especially when he sees a young woman sitting near them who looks like she's probably good in bed and decides to suggest that they go to her place, but too late, she's already out the door with the guy who beat him up and stole his wife. So he has another beer, wondering where he's supposed to live now and realizing it's the bartender who so remarks while offering him another on the house that life is short and brutal, and before he knows it, he'll be dead. He's right. After a few more beers and orgasms, some vaguely remembered, most not, one of his sons, now a race car driver and the president of the company he used to work for, comes to visit him on his deathbed. And apologizing for arriving so late, "I went for a beer, Dad. Things happened." Says he's going to miss him, but it's probably for the best. For the best what? he asks. But his son is gone. If he was ever there in the first place, well, you know, life, he says to the nurse, who's come to pull the sheet over his face and wheel him away. I've always been a sucker for new things and write for this literature, music, art, or new events such as that one. One day just decided to write a story about new things. So this is called The New Thing. She attempted, he urging her on, the new thing. The old thing had served them well, but they were tired of it, more than tired. Had the old thing ever been new? Perhaps, but not in their experience of it. For them, it was always the old thing. Sometimes the good old thing, other times just the old thing. They're like air or stones, part, so to speak, of the furniture of the world into which they had moved and from which, sooner or later, they would move out. It was not at first obvious to them that this world had room for a new thing, it being the nature of old things to display themselves or to be displayed in timeless, immutable patterns. Later, they would ask themselves why this was so, the question not occurring to them until she had attempted the new thing. But for now, the only question that they asked, well, he asked it actually, when she suggested it, was, why not? A fateful choice, though not so lightly taken as his reply may make it seem, for both had come to view the old thing not merely as not merely old or even dead, but as a kind of alive or dead ancestral curse, inhibitory and perverse and ripe for challenge, impossible or even unimaginable, though the new thing seemed until she tried it. And then, when with such success she did, her novelty responding to his appetite for it, the new thing displaced the old thing overnight. Well, not literally, of course, the old thing remained, but cast now into shadow as the furniture of the world, shifting without shifting, lost its familiar arrangements. The old thing was still the old thing. The world was still the world, its furniture, yet nothing was the same, nor would it ever be, they knew, again. It felt, though as in a dream, so transformed was everything, like waking up. This was exhilarating, his word, liberating, hers, and greatly enhanced their delight. She whooped, he giggled, this was fun, their delight in the new thing, which they both enjoyed as much and as often as they could. Indeed, for a time, it filled their lives, deliciously altering perception, dissolving habit, bringing them ever closer together, illuminating what was once obscure while making what before was ordinary now seem dark and alien. This was the power of the new thing, and also, they knew this from the outset, its inherent peril. The new thing, being truly new, not merely a rearrangement of the old, removed the ground upon which even the new thing itself might stand. The old thing's preclusive patterns were like those frail stilts that floodplains housing was erected on. The new thing joined forces with the cleansing flood. Well, as did they, in their unbound joy, having anticipated all this from the start, though perhaps not guessing then how close together delight and terror lay, nor back then considering, as she, he urging, made the new thing happen, how indifferent to their new creation would be both world and thing. Indifferent, but not untouched. All shook, and they, the shakers, were not themselves unshaken. This too, even trembling, they ardently embraced, though perhaps they whooped and giggled less. Scary, she laughed, reaching for him, and he, clinging to her and thinking as he fell that some principle must be at stake, something to do with time, cause, and motion, perhaps, so much the better. Thus, even if somewhat apprehensively in such an altered yet indifferent world, they found pleasure in what might in others inspire dread, their own apprehension mitigated by their shared delight in this new thing, their delight dampened less by antique fears of being swept away in metaphoric floods than by their awareness that the new thing did not, could not know them, nor would or could the world in which they had brought it into being. The new thing which was theirs was, alas, not really theirs at all, nor could it ever be. Moreover, her logic, this, they had chosen the new thing, chose it still, but with the old thing lost from view, what choice was theirs in truth? Were they not, in fact, the chosen? And his reply, let's go back to the old thing just for fun and see. And did they? Could they? Of course. The old thing was waiting there for them as though neither they nor it had ever gone away, like an old shirt left to yellow in the closet, a lost friend discovered in the crowd, and they found new pleasure in returning to it, or at least comfort, and something like reconciliation with the entrenched and patterned ways of the world. The old thing reminds me of my childhood, he acknowledged gratefully. And she, why this appetite for novelty anyway? When we are here so briefly, we don't even have time enough to exhaust the old. Thus, they enjoyed the old thing anew, and in ways they had not done before, chiefly by way of ceasing all resistance, and they told themselves that they were pleased. Of course, they had to admit, after knowing the new thing, it was not quite the same, the old thing, sort of like dried fruit, she said, sweet and chewy now, but not so juicy as before. He agreed, more like body than person, you might say, more carcass than body. They experimented, giving the old thing a new wrinkle or two, but could not sustain their revived interest in it. It was still the old thing, and it still oppressed them. Back to the new thing, which was still there and was delightful and exhilarating as before. They were pleased and did not have to tell themselves they were. What fun, truly. But the new thing, like the old thing, no matter how at first they denied this to each other, was also not the same as it had been before. He, the first to admit it, when regret, bat-like, flickered briefly across her brow. No, she objected, falsely brightening, it is not it, but we who have changed by going back to the old thing. Yes, you were right in the first place, he said. We were not free to choose. But we cannot go back to the new thing either. No, she agreed. We must try a new thing. And so they did. And again, beginning to get the hang of this new thing, they found joy and satisfaction in close accord with one another. Out with old things and old new things, too, they laughed, falling about in their world-shaking pleasure. But was this delight in the new thing as intense as that they'd felt when they'd first tried the old new thing? No, they couldn't fool themselves, far from it. So when the new thing bumped up provocatively against the old new thing, they were filled with doubt and confusion and no longer knew which of the two they most desired or should desire, if either. Out of their uncertainties came another new thing, his handiwork this time, momentarily delightful and distracting, but soon enough this too was replaced by yet another, now hers itself, as soon displaced. Both now were separately busy at what had become more task than pleasure, the devising of new things, now mostly what they did. By now, even the new thing's newness was in question. I am lost, she gasped, falling to her knees. He called out from across the room, I felt oppressed by the old thing. Now I feel oppressed by the new. This is probably, she said, speaking to him by telephone, just the way of the insensate world. We were fooled yet again. No, I can't accept that, he replied by mail, else no new thing is a new thing at all. His letter crossed with hers, saying, my unquenchable appetite for novelty is matched only by my unquenchable appetite for understanding. What a clown. I'm deeply sorry. Adding, I have now become a collector of old things. There's not much fun in them, but there is satisfaction. But wait, he wrote in his diary. Does not the invention of one new thing insist by definition upon a second and a third, a fourth? And indeed, is this not in fact this sequential generation of new things, the real new thing that we have made? And is that not delightful? He thought if he tore this diary entry out and sent it to her, he might well see her again, and they could have fun in their old new things way. But the time for all that was itself an old thing now. And anyway, he no longer knew now, after the flood, where in the world she was. Okay, this summer I've been involved in in this kind of festivals and thinking about writers and readers. And so this is a brand new story. It's not been published and not been read aloud before. Let's hope it works. It's called The Reader. Without, and it's a good short story topic, without a reader of his own, he creates one. In a story he calls The Reader. He decides that she is sensitive, intelligent, discerning, appreciative, widely read, in short, his perfect reader. And she's also exquisitely beautiful, with an endearing smile and a loving, compliant nature. She professes to adore his writing, written specifically for her to read, which encourages him to believe she adores him, too. Well, of course she does. It's his story. How could she do otherwise? So she loves him, adores him, but necessarily in the abstract, as a reader loves the absent writer, alive or dead, lacking the circumstances to express her love more directly, which is his plight as well. He writes a poem inspired by her, brilliant in concept and powerful in its execution, and she reads it, adores it, clasps it to her breasts. Having designed them himself, he knows everything about those breasts, and when he presses the poem to them, it's as though his hands are there too, his lips, but they are not. He can't touch them, though he knows she longs for him to do so. Because he loves her and wants her to be happy, he invents a handsome young man to keep her company. Himself genteel, highly literate, of a warm and generous nature. This development in his story happens during a visit one morning to his local bookstore. As he sits there in the worn leather chair where he always sits, having a second cup of coffee, browsing yesterday's newspapers and taking notes in his little blue notepad, he decides that this is where the two will meet. And they do. She is reading one of his books. The young man has also read it. It's their shared affection for the author that brings them together. The man takes another of the author's books down from the shelf and remarks on its narrative subtleties, its irresistible lyricism, its nobility of purpose. She is awed by his intimate knowledge of a book so dear to her. Soon they are naked. Love blooms between them. She's happy. But he who has brought all this about is not. In fact, writing about them, he suffers a terrible surge of jealousy at the very moment the young man kisses her breasts. Never mind that this man loves his writing. He's gone, hit by a truck, a tragedy. She's deeply sorrowed, being a sensitive person, but too bad. He was not right for her. She knows that now. So he enters the story himself, or someone bearing his name and likeness does. They meet in the same bookstore. He's sitting at a table giving a public reading to a packed, admiring audience, and at the moment she first sees him, she forgets her grief and falls desperately in love with him. It's total surrender. He may do with her as he pleases. First, of course, he has to introduce himself. She does that for him by handing him a book to sign, telling him that it's her favorite of all he's written and the greatest book she's ever read. He smiles up at her, catching the love light in her eyes. His own eyes perhaps reflecting it. It is, he says evocatively, a mere trifle compared to the book he's working on now. She gasps in recognition of the revelatory moment. Her hand at those breasts where his will soon be. Perhaps she intuits that the new book is for her and for her alone. Would you like a cup of coffee, he asks in a seductive manner, returning the signed book to her, or perhaps a glass of wine? No, thank you, says the woman, sitting in the worn leather chair opposite him with a book in her lap, staring at him with something between curiosity, concern, and alarm. He apologizes, explaining that he's an actor, he's auditioning for a play, and was practicing his lines. It's called The Reader, he says, when she asks, as he leaves the bookstore, intending never to return. The reader has also left the bookstore. She is in the apartment of the famous writer she has just met, which is to say his own apartment, or one much like it, though cleaner and more elegantly furnished, with famous etchings on the walls instead of pages torn from magazines. She is admiring his vast library. Well, not much room for etchings, actually. Have you read all these books, she asks. All those in this room, yes. The unread ones are in the bedroom. May I see them? Of course. She picks one up from the stack on his bedside table. By now, she's naked again. She does this so easily. The writer in the story is also removing his clothes, as is he himself, less gracefully, perhaps, than the other two. But what next? He has his hero and heroine naked in a bedroom together, and they're excited. He's excited, but the story is going nowhere. Her radiant beauty, all the more dazzling with her clothes off, has made him forget who she is. His reader, should she be reading something? The book she has picked up, he sees, is a science fiction novel about creatures from outer space, which does not seem promising. He decides to put his clothes on again and go back to the bookstore. Luckily, the chair he prefers is unoccupied, and the same woman is in the chair opposite. It's all quite convenient, and he wonders for a moment if he is in a story someone else is writing. The woman asks him if he got the part for which he was auditioning, and he apologizes and explains that really he's a writer, not an actor. He'd been trying to invade the thoughts and feelings of his characters and became so intensely engaged with him that he got carried away and started speaking their lines out loud, but was ashamed to say so. She finds that quite amusing and says she knows how it can happen. He asks if she's also a writer, and she replies that no, she's only a reader. But she has often heard writers talk about getting confused as to what was real in their lives and what was imaginary, and sometimes something like that happens to her as a reader. He asks her if she's ever felt like she was living in somebody else's story. All the time, she says, but I'm never the main character, she adds with a sad smile. She recalls the line he spoke aloud about going for a glass of wine and asks if that offer's still on. Soon they are both naked, lying on a mattress in her apartment, each with a glass of red wine on the floor beside them. It seems to him it's happened as easily as in the story he's writing. She's not beautiful, and the book she's been reading is a cheap romance, but he's grateful to her. The love felt between the writer, the one who is like himself and bears his name, and the beautiful reader has been consummated, and now the story can move on. She's still deliriously in love, of course, but what about him? On the one hand, he knows that he owes it to his public to remain true to his craft, undistracted by wives and lovers. And on the other, she is his public. The beautiful reader turns toward him with a dreamy smile. I am so honored, she whispers, and his heart melts. As am I, he murmurs. Yet he understands that something's been broken between them. You are beautiful, he adds, but, and his heart aches to say so, you have ruined my story. Her smile does not change. She seems not to have heard him. Well, of course, it was not the writer in his story who said this. It was he himself. The woman lying next to him has risen, perhaps offended. She's already dressing. If you have any money, she says, I'll go buy us a pizza. He untangles his cast-off pants and fishes around in the pockets, realizing that he is indeed very hungry. In his creative throes, he's forgotten about eating. While he's on his hands and knees doing that, she whops his behind. See what else I can ruin, she says with a crooked grin, and swats it again. Mushrooms, pepperoni, sausage, extra cheese, and garlic? Great. He hands her a bill and with a wink sinks back on the mattress. He will leave his writer and reader to their own uncertainties. This is how a story ought to end.
Ewan, can I ask you about your affinity with William Trevor? I mean, is it based on, say, the fact that Trevor's a very fine writer and human nature is the same everywhere? Or do you feel somehow as a Chinese person, some affinity with Ireland and the sort of characters that people, his stories?
That's the hardest question, Peter. It's very hard to answer. It's if you try to explain why you love a writer, it's like you're trying to explain why you love, and it never works that way. But well, I guess my affinity to his work, the only thing I can say is, when you write stories, I'm sure Robert would agree. When you write these stories become their own beings. You send them out to the world and they can be very lonely. And you know, sometimes nobody hear them. And which is okay. But I think oftentimes I imagine these stories I write and I have to send them to the world and they have to find their own friends and, you know, they have to find their own conversational partners. And I just feel that my stories oftentimes would go to a Trevor story, you know, Trevor's stories and talk to his stories. So that's how I feel it, which I'm sorry, I didn't explain it.
Hi. Ooh. Hi. Robert, I'll ask the question, what is cave writing?
About 25 years ago now, something like that, around the late 80s, I was teaching at I better pull closer here. I was teaching at a university at Brown where there had been very early on fascination with the potential of digital formats for all the arts, and in particular of writing. The computer had only been about 20 years old when a very bright young professor there brought a famous computer guru from the 1960s to Brown, and together they fashioned the first ever hypertext editing system. And the decades that followed was a constant consideration of that, improvement of it, and so on. There were groups that gathered together. When I arrived at Brown, I joined those groups and became aware of a lot of things going on in the world that might not have been easy to see elsewhere. And so it became rather transparent to most of us by the end of the 80s that we were in for a revolutionary moment in human discourse, and we should prepare our students for that, and prepare ourselves for it, to know what it was that was happening. So before the World Wide Web existed, I started teaching using the local Brown University software, hypertext fiction workshops, hyperfiction we called it, and this was experiments in using hypertext, which you all now use every day if you're on the computer and you know what it is. It's just multiple links out of a single screen. And the potentially the labyrinthine way that could work in a fiction. So in 1991, I started teaching. That was about the same time that Tim Berners-Lee from this country made the World Wide Web accessible to the general public. He didn't think of it that way. He was thinking of scientific groups. Made it accessible to them by way of opening up the World Wide Web and to use some sort of way to talk on the World Wide Web. He created Hypertext Transfer Protocol, HTTP. So your www.http site opening for URLs, which he also invented, that term as well, all happened in the very early 90s, and so our early experiments were in those formats. Then suddenly, in the mid-90s, everything just boomed because they invented browsers, and browsers allowed us to open up Windows and create our own websites and so on, and everybody could get on, and that's what happened in 94, 95, it was happening. And so our hyperfiction workshops evolved into hypermedia literary workshops, and we were steaming along in that form when this same guy who did that first hypertext editing system brought to Brown an immersive virtual reality space. And this is where you have it's a cube with movie screens, and it's projection from the outside by computers at a very high speed, sending stereoscopic images, and which, when you wear glasses, resolve themselves into 3D experiences. Unlike IMAX, which you no doubt have experienced as a movie thing, this is immersive. So you can step into things where you can't do that on an IMAX screen simply because it surrounds you. So, and you can step into it, you can do things. You can reach for things and move them and have things happen. You can cause lots of events. You can cause everything to change suddenly by just a click of a little tool. And so what we realized we were doing essentially was, from our original hypertext, was spatial hypertext. So those things are called caves. computer augmented virtual environment, I think, something like that. And the course we launched, first of its kind, still one pretty rare, I haven't heard of it elsewhere yet. We launched it in 2002. I taught my first cave writing workshop. And the cave writing workshop was to invite writers in to write for this unique space. The space was something like a theatrical space. When you're in there, you're on stage, and you can manipulate events all around you. It's a little filmic in a way, the way it works, and it's because we insist on we began with models, but we now insist on the predominance, if not the exclusivity, of text. It also becomes a hypertextual environment, a reading environment. And we use audio so that sometimes reading on the screen, as you know, just reading on a computer screen, is not always easy to do. Your eye moves off the screen, or you're looking at the funny little things you can do with it and not listening, not reading the text. So we often augment the printed text, the written text, which is floating around doing different things, with audio text. And students write poems, they write stories, they write experiment with the whole idea. And about 3-4 years ago, for a long time we had to depend on programmers, computer programmers, to be able to run anything or to even put anything in there. Now we've got our own little software system, a text editor, which allows any inexperienced computer type. I mean, writers often have limited computer knowledge, and they don't need it now. They can just, they have a simple user interface and pull down menus, and they can create their own work and move it around, have it happen excitedly. You can watch it on their laptops to see how the stuff works. We have a kind of wireframe 3D screen there that moves around, and then you can take that into the cave room, put it in the computer, and punch a button, run in cave, and bop, there it is all around you. So, and you can edit it as you go then. You can make little changes just like you would edit a story. So that's cave writing in a nutshell, and hyperfiction too. It's the whole range of how this. Now there's, at Brown we formed about a decade ago the Electronic Literature Organization, where ELO.organization or something like that, yelloworganization.org, I forget exactly how it goes, but it's, you can find it and check out all the different projects that are on. You can also download this software and build little things on your own computer if you like. I always, as I said when I got there, I'm interested in what's new, and that was new.
Hello. I wanted to ask both authors why writing is important and necessary to you.
Oh, my. Oh, that is very hard to answer. Why is writing important to me? I did not start as a writer. I used to be an immunologist, so which probably meant writing used to be not important for me. At this moment, it is important. Why?
I've never done anything else. I think writing is the it's the easiest way to get a grip on. Later, I brought along the thing, why do you write, which is when I was going to visit China for the first time, and I wanted something full of paradox, and so I wrote a series of thoughts that I had about writing and why one writes, and then let the computer alphabetize it for me, and so it just runs like that, an alphabetized list. But basically, it's because for me, it's the way into the universe. It's the way I can actually enter into the world in a totally engaged way. I can deal with time, I can deal with space, I can deal with human relations. All of that is there in the possibility of writing. I started writing, when I was about 4 or 5, whenever I learned my ABCs, which is probably the most important thing I ever learned. And then my dad was in newspapers, and so I started making family newspapers. By the time I was about 7, I was writing little stories for them. And then in school, that's all I did. I was a writer, and And then it never occurred to me to be anything else. That was it. And that was the way I related to the world. It was almost the centerpiece of me. That's how I identify myself in a way. And but I wasn't necessarily the writer I am now. It takes a long time to figure that one out. And I left the Navy. I was Korean War days. And when I left the Navy, I had been writing stories that I thought would sell to the popular magazines. And trying to craft them to that aim. But I did some important reading in the Navy, and I was stationed at a place where I had a lot of downtime. I had to go to the base library, and I really got focused, and a lot of the... I was discovering everybody. You know, I discovered Cervantes for the world at that moment. And I was totally engaged with that reading-writing experience. And the writer that most struck me as significant to me was Samuel Beckett. So I got out of the Navy. I rented a, before grad school, I rented a cabin up north of the border in Canada, and took along with me the Bible, which I felt I needed to read cover to cover to see what kind of a novel it was, if the writer was any good, that kind of thing. And then all of Beckett and the Absurdists, and got focused on writing, not as a profession and not as something that just defined me, but as a vocation, something that was in the same way the religious vocation is a vocation. I'm not religious, but it was like that kind of an idea. And that, I think I was taught that by Samuel Beckett. So it was very important to me. That little, it was 30 days, you know, living on peanut butter on an isolated island and up in Rainy Lake, and only a little boat to get back and forth, no electricity, no, but it was perfect. And I got myself totally focused, and from that time on, I've been the kind of writer I became then and that I am now, I think. But it's really, I think everybody should write. I think you should all do it. You know, not everybody is going to do it brilliantly, but it's really a good thing to do. And whether it's writing family stories or love stories or making up invented things, science fiction, whatever, all of it helps to get, first of all, it makes you a better reader. I always tell my writers to write first, read next, because it'll make you the better reader if you start writing right away. And but also it makes you, I think, a more engaged person in the world. So I recommend it as a, you know, for the whole population.
What's Robert? And you, what's your medium for writing? Do you use pen and paper or a computer?
Well, you know, like everybody else, I started, everybody else my age, when there were no computers, and I nevertheless started on a typewriter, working for my dad's paper, as I soon was by the time I was about 14 or 15. Everything is done with those old standard, very heavy to hit, hard to hit keys. Stand-up typewriters, big old heavy things. And that's what all the copy was prepared on. And so I took touch typing in high school. I was the only guy in this class of girls, and fought to have the fastest speed. And I got there. I was the fastest typist in the class, provided you didn't count mistakes, because you have to do that, as it turns out. But so I didn't. I ranked fairly low. But if you don't count the mistakes, I was really fast. And that was all you needed in the paper, in the newspaper world, because you get this copy, it rushed to your desk. You got to make some changes. You got to bang, 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 bang this stuff. It doesn't matter if you make mistakes. You just exit out and send it back to, in those days, to the linotypist. So I did start there rather than with pen and ink. And then years go by, and the computer comes along, and I get really involved. And the first thing I discovered when I first started, I don't do this anymore, but what I first discovered was that I could ask for printout. It was all printed at the university. We didn't have printers. We didn't have laptops or anything like that in those days. We were working off the mainframe, but you could ask for portrait or landscape. Well, if you ask for landscape, you have this big blank space down one side, which is perfect for scribbling on, you know, changing things. And that was so inviting. I went out and bought pen, and I started for the first time writing by hand, and I loved it. I just wrote all the time, wrote on all, even when I didn't have anything to do with the story I was working on. It was just that inviting space. So since then, I do a lot of writing by hand, by pen and ink, but I would say 90%, I mean, I work directly on a computer. I don't
translate to it. I just work with it as a natural tool, a very good tool.
We had the same about. Yes, I, of course, I use a computer, and now more and more I start to use pen and, you know, writing a notebook, because in that way you cannot revise your thought. You know, I notice that when I'm writing on the computer, I'm more an eraser than a writer. You know, I go back rather than forward. So with a pen, you cannot revise your thoughts. So I love that.
Hi there. Really for Robert, just to say, I can remember about 25 years ago, talking to a friend of mine. He said he'd just come back from France, and a member of Her Majesty's British Customs had just confiscated Spanking the Maid because it seemed to be a bad book. And I thought,
here it is, it's a classic.
Yeah. I thought you might like to know that.
No.
And just also to say that The Public Burning is one of those great novels that at least doesn't seem to get talked about as much as it ought to, because, you know, it is one of the great American novels.
Well, thank you for that. I did this night before last, did in fact get an email referring to it, but it had another purpose in mind. It was an 80-year-old activist in the States who was writing to ask me to call up a particular reporter. It was just about, well, at the time it was about an hour before, and then it became about 5 hours before the execution of Troy Davis, which I'm sure you've all been following that horror story, and wanted me to intervene, but he did it by way of the Public Burning. I mean, by using that as his at least his post for getting me connected. I had already been participating in that resistance thing. But yeah, I'm glad to hear the story of Her Majesty's government. I got stopped many times coming through with various things. I didn't get stopped by my own books, luckily. But I'm not surprised that happened. By the way, one of the other things I do at Brown is run this Freedom to Write program. And this began because of the incidents in China that I had invited Salman Rushdie to come read at Brown. He was going to read from a new book whose title was unknown to us, Satanic Verses. And it was due to read in March, and in February, the fatwa came down against him. And so we had a new president then with whom I got on extremely well. And I asked him if he would send a letter to Salman inviting him to come anyway, in spite of the difficulties, and give the reading if he wanted to express his own freedom of expression. And it took a long time to get a letter to Salman and back again, because he was being protected by all Her Majesty's police force. And so when it did come back, it said, no thanks, I'm keeping my head down, but I appreciate it very much. And I wanted to go tell the president about that, and the first chance I had was the day after Tiananmen Square. Mm. And so I took the letter to him and said, you know, Salman is very appreciative and thanks you very much for your offer. It's very good of Brown to put itself on the line, to put its head, his, not only the university at risk, but himself. He was born in Iran, this president, and yet to do it very courageously. So I thanked him for that, and he just kind of brushed it off. And he said, do you have any Chinese friends in trouble? Mm. I said, oh, yeah. And so he said, I think I can do something for them. And we began a Freedom to Write program then with, at that time, first three Chinese writers, eventually eight or nine, brought some others, Cuban, Somali, etc. And then we ran out of money. And then we got the money back from a foundation finally about 10 years ago, something like that. And now we run it in a grander way. But we're hoping to bring her next year is a Tibetan poet, Wozer. You know her work?
Yes. She's always in danger, isn't she? Yes.
So, she can't get out.
It's going to be really hard.
We've got one at the back. Hi there. A question for Robert about the all of those stories that you read tonight kind of share a particular rhythm, a particular voice. And I wondered how easily that comes to you and whether that voice is one that you've written with for a long time. Is that a new thing?
The new thing goes back a ways, yeah. The new thing's an old thing. The other two are new things. I don't really think about it much, but I working with prose, as Yuyan knows, is itself a craft, and you just have to keep playing at it and listening in your own ear for what it is you're doing. And if I sometimes sound like myself, well, that's an accident. I'm trying not to. I like to think I've got the world's voices in my head. The only person who really did that perfectly was Shakespeare, but even he added his own tonalities. And so I run a wide range of voices. It just, I think, happened that those, I started to read another one, that I got to about the last page. I was going through it and realized it was a line almost like one of the ones in this story, so I had to back off from that one. Again, when people start writing, when you're working as a young writer and as an older person starting as a young writer, it's not something necessarily to be striven for itself. You want to strive for kind of the truth and the truth as it concerns the metaphor you're working with. So if you're working with a metaphor that's very severe and dark, well, the language will reflect that in some way if it's going to be any good. And if you're working with something that's more lighthearted and kind of got a bit of playfulness in it, then obviously it'll pick up. I think these pieces all had playfulness in them. Not all my pieces are like that.
Thanks. I'd like to ask Ian Lee a question also about voices, because I noticed that voices were quite important in that extract that you read. And you said that the voice of your narrator, Moyan, came to you when you were in a hotel room. And I was just curious, could you tell us whether she was speaking to you in English or in Chinese?
That's a very good question. It's actually very strange that, you know, I think many of you probably know that my first language is Chinese and I write only in English. In fact, I think she speaks to me in English. All my characters speak to me in English, and which is, of course, impossible because they're all Chinese characters. But I think what happens is, English is my first language in writing, and when I think about characters, when I think about their thoughts, they come to me in English, which sometimes actually becomes a problem, because I remember I have this lovely British editor. She read my novel manuscript. She said, oh, it's wonderful, except, you know, sometimes your characters speak American English. Mm-hmm. And she said, right away, I'm in an American high school, or, you know, I'm in the football, like a bleacher. So she said, you need to be careful with your English. And of course, you know, her being British, she said, you need to go for, you know, a little bit more British sounding English, which also doesn't work. So in the end, I introduce a little bit of Chinese idioms, you know, I translate them myself so they sound a little bit, you know, odd. I think I'm always afraid that my English will be too fluent, or my character's English will be too fluent for the readers. So you have to do a little bit of that. But she speaks to me in English. Everybody speaks to me in English.
I wanted to thank Ewan and Robert for an absolutely wonderful session this evening. I think we've been privileged to hear two remarkable readings from two amazing writers at different stages of their career. So I'd like us all to thank them.
Also to say that they'll be at the bookstall in 3 minutes where you can carry on a conversation with some small wonder beer and ask for their signature in the books that you've bought. Ewan, have we got the paperback of Ewan's books? You've got it in paperback, haven't you? I'm not sure whether we have the paperback or the hardback. And Robert's, the stories that you read are the Penguin Modern Classics that they want to get rid of are certainly at the back there, and actually they're very beautiful objects. And you can browse around some of his other books as well. Thank you both very much.
Yeah, you know, Mr. Did you work with him at some point?
No, because I...